Friends, for four decades and maybe even more, a supposed guest on my programs when he came to town, is Tim Pat Coogan. And actually, he never wound up as a guest. He became a co-host. And actually, he became a host, and I was relegated to being a co-host. So, you know, we had a neighbor back in my parish of Essimath, and Sis Morton, and Sis would say, "Isn't it lovely to see you coming and going?" Well, so let me link up now with my friend of four decades, and welcome Tim Pat Coogan. How are you doing there, Tim Pat?
I'm doing very well, Adrian, in the belief that you're happier to see me come than going.
Of course.
Very good.
It's been a long road for both of us, but you know, it does bring us back though to a part of your career where, you know, now that we're in the centenary of the Easter Rising, you raised some shackles, in writing about the 50th anniversary back in 1966. And whereas you are indeed a very respected writer, you seem like you're also kind of an equal opportunity offender, particularly for any politicians living or dead.
How can you tell the difference between them?
All right, we're off to a good start. Anyway, your 16th book is now released in time, indeed, for as Ireland's best-known historical writer. You have now launched Tim Pat Coogan's 1916, The Mornings After. It was published indeed, but is now at the end of last year. But it's a strongly personal perspective on the Irish century that followed the Rising.
Yeah, that's a fair description, I think.
Well, but what I'd like, Tim Pat, what I'd like you to do, though, for the benefit of those who hear very little about 1913, it kind of gets lost in the history of Ireland, but you have an insight into the year 1913 that I'd like you to share.
Well, I think it's a very perceptive question. You know, we had this terrible austerity period, 7 years of it, like the plagues of Egypt, because of the corruption and the misgovernment, disgraceful behavior of developers and bankers and politicians and regulators who didn't regulate. And they all disappeared into the wide blue yonder with huge salaries and pensions. Whereas the ordinary people who faced the crash, a lot of them just disappeared. In the 7 years, as many people committed suicide as were killed in the 30 years of the Troubles. A generation was lost to emigration, unemployment. People had their medical cards taken away. Pensions were cut or disappeared. Some of the bank shares, like Allied Irish Bank, they went from 20 euro to, I think, they're 1.5 cents at the moment. And when it's finally sold off, there'll be thousands of workers unemployed. So anyway, all that had a knock-on effect, and people who tightened their belts and bore them up with sacrifices because in the national interest over the 7 years, they have been stirring recently for the last year. There's been a lot of rumbling under the surface, and while the focus was on 1916 and the anniversary, and very rightly so, and it passed off very well, suddenly an awful lot of very important key workers are putting in wage demands, trying to catch up with the 7 years wage freeze during the austerity. And there's threats of really serious trouble. The police, for example, one of the unions, the police unions, the other day, the guy in charge of it said he was prepared to go to jail. He was going to deliberately break the law by having calling for a strike to make the point that they've been without money for a long time, without raises. The numbers have gone down, and a policeman on the streets of Ireland is nearly as rare as a red Indian on the banks of the Hudson. And that's just one key area, but we're going to have the spectacle as part of that process of the cops marching to protest in uniform to the door. And they're going to be policed as they march by cops in uniform. And we hope that when they get there, there'll be a government. So it kind of gives you an encapsulated picture of the simmering discontent. There's also the Lewis, that's the rail line that goes through Dublin, some 19,000 passengers a day affected by a series of strikes there. And that's looking very bad. It looks as though that there won't be just day-long strikes. They're going to be an all-out strike, which has every possibility of spilling over into the national rail grid, and the bus transport could go as well. The teachers are making noises, and the politicians are just thrashing around. So 1913, of course, was the great lockout. It was the labor dispute which shook the foundations of the state and was one of the precursors of the 1916 climate. James Connolly led that, and he was co-opted then into the IRB Supreme Council, and joined Pearce and Clark and the others in the GPO in 16. So all the time people were rather affectionately and nostalgically looking back at 1916, this labor cloud has been building up. So I think it's time to look at the lessons of 1913 as well as those of 1916 and try to move forward from them. But there isn't too much sign of movement at the moment. The activity without movement seems to be the leitmotif of our political life.
You know,
sorry.
Yes. Tim Pat,
yep.
As you describe the austerity, the last 7 years, the struggles in Ireland at the political level and indeed at every which level, you might, you know, tell us about the Ireland, say, from the for a few years before this, when Ireland was actually, particularly in the cities, it didn't manage to wind its way down to west of the Shannon. But everything was flourishing. It was the bowl was full and over full, and everybody, you wouldn't begrudge anybody for having a taste of the good life.
That's true, but unfortunately it wasn't all that flourishing. The thing was that the basic maxim that there's no such thing as a free lunch was forgotten, and people weren't allowed to remember that credit is debt. And the banks were giving out money to the tune of 105% mortgages, and they were inflating the prices of house property to crazy levels. And when the crash came, one of the causes of suicide, and now homelessness, it's a terrible problem of homelessness, was the negative equity and the huge mortgage repayments. And now a lot of the banks and a lot of the mortgage companies, they've sold off these mortgages and debts to vulture capitalists, and they're now hovering over the country, and with the result they're evicting people. There has been very little actual building done, and the result has been that rents have soared, and every per day now somebody's been evicted. People are sleeping homeless in the streets. Families are being housed by the station hotels. You can imagine having kids, you know, playing out in the corridors, can't let them out in the street. And, you know, if you have an autistic child, you can't let the child out even in the corridor. So there's terrible pressures on the society. And the thing that's really maddening about it is the lack of accountability. The people who caused all this got away with it. For example, one of the things the government tried to do, the present government, well, the ex-government, when they came in first, they tried to hold a referendum to amend the constitution. The idea was that they would be allowed there to set up Dáil committees on the lines of the congressional committees to inquire just who was responsible, who was on first base. You know, asking the chairman, did you realize that the bank was going into debt? If you didn't realize it, why didn't you? You know, that kind of question. Because we were good enough to pay up 70 billion. I mean, imagine a billion in terms of Ireland. The national debt is over 200 billion. And with the population we have, it means that my great-great-grandchildren won't see that debt paid. But anyway, just when the referendum was being held, and unfortunately, it was entrusted to a lawyer or two to run it. A group of ex-attorney generals wrote a letter to the media saying that if this thing carried, it would interfere with the man's right to his good name and it would undermine the independence of the judiciary. So with these august personages combined with the distrust people were feeling for politicians generally, the referendum was actually lost, and nobody ever got to find out who did what. And in the general sort of controversy, they overlooked the fact that two of the signatories of that letter were former chairmen of Allied Irish Bank. You know, the blatancy of the thing, the annoyance it's caused, you know, there hasn't been in Ireland a general sense of outrage at, you know, the general conduct of affairs. People kind of put up with it and say, oh, sure, you know yourself, have another drink and get on with it. But that's worn thin now. People have a sense of outrage. I mean, the last election showed you that the penny was dropping with people. They vented their anger on the system. There was this crazy number of independents returned, and the traditional parties were decimated. And that's where you got all the difficulties of forming a government, because the tectonic plates, as it were, of Irish politics have shifted. So it's not a pleasant picture. I mean, at the same time, you have to sense of proportion. I mean, a country that came through the famine will come through this. These are problems of irritation compared to problems of desperation. But it is very hard to put up with people on the one hand escaping completely stock free for their misdeeds, and on the other, the very decent people who put up with all this, the ordinary Sean and Mary and their children, are suffering, whereas the wealthy upper crust are getting by very nicely, thank you. And as you said there, the cities, if you went over to Ireland tomorrow, you'd be struck by the seeming prosperity of Dublin, the cars in the street, the restaurants full. But if you looked a little closer, you'd find the homelessness, you'd find that old people are frightened of alone, particularly in the country. The crime is disgraceful. We had a mafia-style funeral in Dublin recently. A part of the cortege was for the murdered gangster. There were 12 stretch limos, 12 Mercedes stretch limos holding up the traffic. Mountains of flowers and all the vulgar, gaudy trappings, all based on crime, and, you know, the people looking on helplessly. So it's not a very happy scene, to say the least of it.
Yeah, well, Tim Pat, though, I wanted to tell you that you are painting a picture not unlike what we have in New York City.
Oh, they're telling me that here. Yeah, I know that. Yeah, I see it. I hear it in every hand, yeah.
And
the other thing we have, sorry to cut across you, but we have a phenomenon that you were familiar with for years. The young people are not voting.
Right.
Which is a disastrous development. You know how hard the vote was fought for world wars with, you know, with our independence struggle, and they just turned their backs on it. I mean, I don't want to interfere in American politics, in American election. God knows we have enough problems of our own. But it just strikes me as a very sad irony. One of the great democratic highs of Europe in my lifetime was when we saw the Berlin Wall come down. Mm-hmm. This was democracy really bursting through. And here we have a presidential candidate for one of the great parties, and he's running on a plank, as it were, of building walls. So that strikes me as a very bad sort of development in American public life.
Yeah, well, without getting too deeply into it, that's one of the milder suggestions that the unnamed candidate has.
Let's just say that in your view and in mine, he's not coming up trumps.
I just, you know, we have, and I must say that you know, I put myself to the fore. Over the last 5 years, we have been, chuffed to broadcast the tremendous resurgence, the improving economy, the shining light of Ireland and its tradition of rising from the ashes, excusing the pun and the year that's in it. But maybe because the Taoiseach, Prime Minister of Ireland, is from my home county, everything was positive, positive, positive from our view here, and we were ready to take on anybody who said that everything was in the Shochron at home, and that there was no, you know, even, economists throughout the world were again looking at Ireland and saying, well, fair play to these people, you know. Whatever, they can be at the depths of depression economically and socially because of events. And then before you know it, they're back up again. They're ahead of schedule in terms of the recovering economy.
Yeah, that's it's true. And we have this instinct to defend the country, and we've had it for centuries, you know, because we were living in the lee of with the Cuba of Western Europe. We have the great power lag off our shores. So the encouragement was always, quote, not to be let down the country, as it were.
Right.
But the facts were somewhat different. I mean, the actual Irish economy is a bit like the curate's egg, which we were told was good in parts. As I say, the homelessness, the lower the number of people on, if you take another matrix, you know, a metric, say the soup kitchen thing that Brother Kevin runs, a wonderful example of the old style monk, Capuchin monk, Brother Kevin, Cork man. I mean, the number of meals that he's giving out now, it would frighten you, the number of extra people coming. You have a couple of voices raised. Both, it's actually the sternest critics are coming from the church or the exemplars, like Father Peter McVerry, the Jesuit, or Sister Stanislaus, of Mercy Nun. And they have focused attention on the homelessness when nobody else was doing it. And there's a kind of a nomenclature. If you listen to economists or Paul Kors, they're kind of in a bubble. You hear them on RTE talking away about the economy. And a word you never hear mentioned is suicide. You never hear, I mean, you hear statistics about jobs and the politicians were orating going into the election that jobs, 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 jobs are the answer to everyone.
Right.
That is true as far as it goes, but it's a bit like live horse and you get grass. In the meantime, what happens, you know? And the recovery was very uneven. Obviously, the crazy house prices would hardly be reached again, but it's still a fair, it's a third at least, if not more, back from the top level of the boom years at the moment, the house price thing. And while it is true that by some metrics we would be the fastest growing economy in Europe, remember, Adrian, if you stand up from the floor, you're a lot taller than you were, but you're not that high.
Yeah. You know, you haven't changed much over the decades. To take on or to even talk about the taboo subject of suicide and its direct relationship with a country that that indeed, and I suppose maybe we do it ourselves here, but you want to keep the bright side out. Talk about suicide and how that relates to, say, the last 7 years of the after the crash.
Well, it would be a little further back. The last year or two, things are improving a bit, but the numbers of suicide are extremely high, you know, well above what used to be. As you say, it was a taboo subject. And it's very hard to get the exact figures. I mean, I'm going on the published government figures, but a lot of people out of a sort of a decent reticence don't report suicide for the sake of the family or the neighbors or whatever.
Right.
But there is no sector of Irish life that wasn't affected by it in some way or another. What affected me was, I didn't actually know the man, but he walked the same streets I did. He lives out in my direction or lived. And he, his business went down. And his brother emigrated. He turned to driving a taxi. Word came then from Canada that the brother had committed suicide. And 3 weeks later, that man took his taxi, and he drove not far from where I live, a couple of miles just, to a local cemetery. And he tied one end of a rope to a tree, and then he fed the rope back into the car, tied the other end around his neck, revved up the engine and drove off. The consequences better imagined than described. Sort of that kind of focused me on the suicide. I began looking around, and the first group that I spoke to were taxi people, and I found that there were an enormous amount in relation to the small number of people in the taxi business compared to the population as a whole. And a lot of them had committed suicide, and the man I spoke to, the sort of savant of the group that I knew, he was running a kind of benevolent fund for them. They're a fractious lot, like the Irish, everywhere they've split. And he was in a small section, his union or his segment of the taxi drivers. But he was catering to 60 families who'd lost a breadwinner to suicide. And it's much greater, of course, in the taxi as business as a whole. And that's only one segment, young and old, Hamilton. There's one reason for not talking too much about it, because it tends to spread. There's a kind of a copycat effect. But it is there. It's a reality. And if you took, I remember adding up the numbers, in 600 a year or something, 700 a year, whereas in the whole 30 years of the Troubles, 3,500 people about were killed. And this, in the first 7 years of austerity, that number was achieved, if that's the word. And it's still, you know, well above the normal. And it's really not, still not a national talking point. It's, you know, don't mention the war, don't mention the elephant in the room. But that was there, and that gloom, you know, the other things that helped to bring it about were there. And the electorate sort of reacted. That's why you have this, the result we got, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was telling you on the way over in the plane, it was an Aer Lingus plane, and the usual, as we all remember, Aer Lingus, of course, is not run by the state anymore, but it is a very intrinsic part, an important part of the Irish-American experience. And the girls are still dressed in the green uniforms, still green livery on the aeroplane. And coming over, I wanted to find out. There was a vote in the doll that afternoon. And none of the staff were. It didn't affect them. So finally, one of them got on to the captain. And the captain's reaction was, I couldn't care less. I don't know what's happening in the doll. I don't want to know. He was flying an airplane. That was enough for him.
Yeah.
But I mean, in Ireland, as you remember, you're interested in politics. The great days of your uncle, your great uncle Paul O'Dwyer. People would be hanging on every word of the political developments, you know.
Yeah.
Working out what things were happening. But that turn off is bad, you know. It is true still, you know, when people can't get the kind of government they deserve, and apathy, and don't want to know, and all that.
Yeah.
It's bad, you know. Now, there are some good things still. I mean, one of the things that's still there, and it's very pronounced in Irish America, is the generosity of the Irish. That's still there. It's there's still the tradition of voluntarism, of going out to the missions. Well, they don't go to missions, but they do go and help the Third World. They do help people like Brother Kevin that I mentioned.
Yes.
He's a huge army of helpers. And that's still there, people willing to turn to a good cause. And you see it in spades over here where people have a bit more money. In fact, there's something, if I may mention it to you, that I'm interested in because of my own sight problems. It's called Fighting Blindness, and a group of consultants, including my own, there's a guy we know called Tony Ward, who has gone blind. I think you may know him.
Yes.
But he's a kind of heroic fellow. He goes out jogging in the morning, you know, for 10 miles along the road, you know, with a stick. And I realized there at a book club, at the launch of this book we were talking about, actually, Tony came along with the doctor, Des Keegan, and Des and Tony were standing in front of me, and I'd signed the book for him, and I was handing it to Tony, who was standing in front of me, and he was putting out his hand, and he was kind of standing there, but not moving to take the book, and I suddenly realized that a simple thing like that, you've got to say to him, if he's out of his way, you, okay, go jogging in the morning, because he knows the route, but unless you say, Tony, I am handing you this book at your right hand, it's 6 inches off the ground, you know, he's helpless. And this is a very fit guy, you know. Hit him. The type of blindness he has, it hits people in their early 30s. And it's reversible. It can be fixed. There's research
yeah.
done on it. And what I'm hoping to achieve is get some good Irish-Americans together to espouse the cause and get some money for it. It's already reduced the years, you know, of sight that they can give you is not up, and they can bring it right up. They can hit it if a bit of
okay. What's the organization? By the way, he was a guest. He was
it's called Fighting Blindness.
Okay.
His doctor actually treats me too. Des Keegan, and I know them all. They're very worthy people. And the guy I'm talking about is the same name as the famous Irish rugby player Tony Ward. So. Watch this space. I'll get you a few more details. But if some of your Irish Americans, a few of your guys, you know, and the busier they are, the better. And the more commitments they have, I know it's terrible. But those are the kind of guys who can always take on something else. It's the people who have plenty of time in their hand to do nothing that don't put their hand in their pocket. But four or five of them of the right sort of people could kill this thing off, you know. And
it is a breakthrough. It's not just
It is, it is. And it's the kind of thing that I'm proud to say that though all the other things, the bad things I've mentioned are true, but that side of the Irish character is there also. I very much like the veil of it, you know.
But
that's where you were saying, you know, we claw our way back despite the terrible things. We come back out of the ashes.
And it is the fact, and one that we ought to be proud of and definitely known in the Irish diaspora, that the Irish are, in fact, the most generous you know,
without a doubt, I've seen it everywhere. I've seen it from Newfoundland to Australia. You've seen it Scotland. I've just been in Scotland. And, you know, they get together. They fight with each other. And they drink too much and all the usual things. But as somebody said to me in Russia once, okay, he said, there are no good things, but there are no good things.
But I think some of that we would have to acknowledge has to do, you know, with our own great hunger, the Irish famine, the great hunger, what an indelible mark that left, you know, in the
yeah, I mean, the it did the that certainly was part of it. I mean, there was a lot of bad things happened that time too. The Irish weren't as good as they might have been. And there's still racism, and there's still hostility to refugees. You know, we're finding a bit of that creeping up too, and we're kind of a bit helpless in the face of the refugee crisis affecting Europe from the wars in the Middle East. But
I just want to spend a couple of minutes on that.
Yeah,
you have. And this is not peculiar to Ireland, but the refugee crisis in the midst of, you know, particularly in Europe, where God knows they've, you know, Europe has its own problems at many levels. Some of it will be deeply affected if, you know, if Britain pulls out of the EU, that'll be another kettle of fish to deal with.
Oh, yeah, we should talk about that, because there's a dimension to that. Don't mention the war, you know, but it could affect the border.
Yeah, but in the sense that, you know, it's easier maybe for us here to say, wouldn't you think that Europe would open itself more and extend, you know, the hand of friendship in desperation. We're sitting on the ditch over here saying, yeah, you know, absolutely. Yet it brings us back to the adage, you know, and this is all very good, but not in my backyard.
Well, the thing is, what we have seen, rumors we're getting to with a few that have come to Ireland, you know, there is are outbursts of racism. A couple of very ugly things in the news in the last week or two. Anti-blacks, and a Polish family indeed attacked in Wexford. But the reality of the thing is, for a long time, Ireland have been getting by on it. A lot of talk about us going out to the Third World and helping them, but it takes forever to get naturalized or to get through the hoops that the Irish erected for immigrants to get a job in the country, to be allowed to work. And that's a scandal that we allowed to fester on. And suddenly then this terrible crisis occurs in the Middle East, and the blowback from that awful decision to go to the war in Iraq, Libya, etc. And we were kind of caught, what could we do? And you'd be surprised at the amount of racism. People say, oh, look, we don't want those guys coming in here, letting off bombs in supermarkets, and don't want, you know, this little country is a lot of empty space, a lot of people are eyeing it, they want to get in here, and we'll be overrun. And at the other level, you have people who are in the front line. Like, I heard a petty officer on one of, we had a warship all through the, but still there. It's a different warship. They go out to the sea, out to the Mediterranean, and they try to rescue people from these boats making the impossible crossing from mainland Africa over to Greece, to Turkey, and Italy, and so on. And they were interviewing this guy, very calm. He was obviously a well-trained Irish officer. You know, they're very good at that kind of stuff, very good at the peacekeeping. That's another plus for the Irish peacekeeping in the Middle East. They're good at it. But this guy was very unemotional, but very human. And somebody said to him, you must see terrible sights. And he said, oh, you do indeed. And he started talking about the one that abided with him. They had found this woman floating dead in the water with her dead baby beside her, still attached to her by the umbilical cord. So that's the reality that lies behind the refugee thing. And so before there's any knee-jerk hostility to you, or any, on the other hand, an impossibly open-door policy, you have to recognize the human dimension of the tragedy, mm-hmm. just as what you're talking about.
Yeah, but there...
Economics,
yeah.
You have to talk about suicide, you know?
Right. I know, but with respect to the refugee and the refugee crisis, there are quite a number of people in Ireland who say we have taken care of, we've addressed that issue, we have had more than our share of refugees which we welcomed in the good times. And maybe, you know, that can be fluffed over.
No, I don't think that's true. I don't think even in the good times. I mean, Mary Robinson came out about our system of direct provision, they call it. Give them a pittance, keep them in kind of camps, and process them forever, filling in forms. And they never let out of the camps, and every form of mischief occurs, and they never get a job, they go settle, and they're quietly sent back. They've speeded up the resettlement thing, and they're sending back down. But it's in the good times, we didn't do it. Now in the bad times, it's obviously harder. But the numbers are still, they're very small. And I mean, Lawrence, you mentioned the famine, and you're right. No country in Europe for a long time benefited as much as the Irish did from emigration. And in the days, you know, when that woman cast in bronze standing out there at the mouth of the Hudson was talking about giving me your poor, your huddled masses. Well, that came over here, and we have, you know, we went from the coffin ships and the Five Points to the Rose Garden at the White House with the Kennedy Ascension, you know. And I think, and you could see it there in the, you know, even the Twin Towers, the Irish at every level of society, from the cops, the firefighters, right up to the Cantor Fitzgerald at the very top of it, in the Financial Services Center. The Irish have done so well as immigrants, and they're so well respected as a class. I mean, they tell you in Australia, if you're Irish, you're lucky, you know, because the doors are open.
Yeah, but
the response
that
in Ireland, though, with that background, it's not commensurate with our history. I'm afraid you have to say that in all sadness and sincerity.
Yeah, but
acknowledging the difficulty and the thorniness of the issue and all the rest. The fact is, we haven't been as good as our history would seem to indicate.
Yeah, well, you know, I've tried now to stop biting my tongue here, and it's not working. because you
Male
rightly...
people don't bite themselves. Generally, get out of the word by biting everybody else. That's how you get teachers.
We're particularly good at taking a snap at dubs, by
yes.
the way.
Not too good when it comes to the old Sam Maguire, I'm afraid. the history is there.
But, you know, you have talked about the great contribution, and we all do, of the Irish to America. And here we are, you know, with even before immigration and immigration reform became a dirty, filthy word and something which the best of politicians would like to stay away from, here we have, in return for the great contributions that the Irish have made to America, they're grouped in, you know, we're put on that list of ne'er-do-wells who will only, you know, become a burden on the United States. It's disgraceful.
It is
shameful.
Yeah.
And, you know, the great relationship with Ireland and America with Ireland, the relationship between America with New York to 1916, all of that seems to not amount to a hill of
beans. You're absolutely right. Yeah. You know, the way the visa thing has been treated, the embassy in Dublin is not what it used to be, the haven it used to be. You know, evil days have fallen. From the Irish perspective, the problem is if the bloodline doesn't keep flowing, that this Irish diaspora thing we talked about would become a matter of the grandfather and the grandmother.
Oh, sure.
You know, it won't be the young guys who are going into, well, you do have some of the cream of the crop coming over here, going to make big jobs, educated people, but it's only a trickle, it's only a handful. And
yeah.
I mean, Ireland can really look upon itself validly as a mother country that has shed its blood for this country from civil war to, you know, war of independence, whatever. And the I don't think the fighting Irish story of the wars needs to be, you know, retold. But certainly the payback for it is very ungenerous. And there seems to be in the world a general... as you said, not in my backyard. Don't drag your... I don't care who you are, Jack. Don't drag your crucifix across my lawn, you know?
Yeah. I just want to get back to your book, 1916, The Mornings After. Your perspective on the century since the Rising, it does kind of concentrate on the flaws and obviously corruption and institutional clerical abuse and all of it. What a century later? How far have we come? Because we are celebrating, we are commemorating not just the Rising of 1916, but how far we have actually come as a nation, the diaspora, and what that actually amounts to. You know, there are those who say, well, you know, Coogan is going to air the dirty laundry, and there isn't that much of a balance in what he writes. Ah, that's a good one. Devil's advocate there. Take that one.
Yeah. Well, you've got that balance between, you know, don't be down the country and then say that the, look at how well dressed, how well the emperor looks the suit on him, you know.
Sure.
And he's stark naked. The mood that I wrote that book in is very different to the one I had in. One of the problems about writing about Ireland is we have the laziest set of academic historians in the English-speaking world. The Irish academic historians will not talk about... I mean, for example, you've used the word diaspora a lot. They have never written about the diaspora. There's some stuff written over here by Irish-Americans in America. But where have they written about it? What book by any historian can you pick up in Ireland? They take... no interest once the door closes, you know. It's just our own right little, tight little society.
Yeah.
None of them have written about the IRA, for example, that small organization that rather preoccupied us for 30 years. They wouldn't write about the hunger strikes. You know, it's very middle class, very... but there is a historian over here in Ireland, over in America, Joe Lee, and Joe attributes it to the influence of... Peterborough House in Cambridge, so many of them went through that college and they came out with that, what I would call colonial cringe. They write very emollient stuff. And they're not used to talking about the emperor not being well-dressed, the emperor being naked. And anything can be magnified into, they have kind of a tinsel thing that they do criticize, coffee table stuff,
yes.
You know, letters to the Irish Times, depth stuff. But the serious the way the country has been going is not being held up by the scholars and looked at. And in 16, in the 50 years, the significant thing about my book in 1966 when it came out is that it was the only history of the period. Academia ignored everything that happened from 1916. As far as my generation and yours is concerned, history stopped at 1916. Civil War got in the way and they weren't going to examine the issues, they weren't going to, you know, highlight the unpleasant things, and in that era it was possible also in 1966 to be optimistic because we were very insular, we were very inward looking, and suddenly a whole lot of things broke the mold and things from outside came in. There was The Vatican Council was very important because of the Catholicism of Ireland at the time, and that Pope, Great Pope John, the influence of John Kennedy, for example, is very telling. And we were having, we weren't in the EEC at the time, but we were in, our foreign policy was drawing a lot of attention at the UN. I mean, even to this day, the only statutory instrument for non-proliferation of nuclear weapons is the Irish resolution. I mean, the Irish voted against Cardinal Spellman, which is they voted for the admission of China to the UN. So there was quite a lot of reason to be optimistic, but it all sank back into Pádraic crumbling at the greasy till, that they didn't want to know about the 75th anniversary of 16 because of the troubles there. If you started praising the men in 1916, you'd have people saying, well, what's the difference with the provost? They couldn't have that. So they almost ignored it. So there's been an almost overcompensation. It looked as though it was going to be the bowing and scraping and a lot of controversy. Would they advise, would they take the Queen over, for example, was a great debate. Would we be insulting the unionists to re-celebrate it? But at the end, the people kind of took ownership of it. And the way they reacted to all the programs the government put on shows they were proud of it. And it was a very good commemoration. It wasn't a word said out of place, just a decent pride. You know, it's getting along towards Bastille Day or Independence Day here. It's a huge date in the history of the country. A matter for pride, not for rancor or finger pointing or anything. And along suddenly crashed all the hopes with the peace process. And if, suddenly, if you were, say, a hard-headed unionist and you wanted to, you wanted me or you to convince me that you should join the United Ireland, you look at the crash, would you come in? You would not. I mean, we're commemorating 1916, on day one of this year, of the anniversary, 100 years, would James Connolly have effectively taken us out of the British National Health Service if he could realize that on the first day of the new year, of the anniversary year, January the 1st, there were 500 people on trolleys in hospital waiting for a bed in hospitals in Ireland. And those figures haven't improved over the year. So, I mean, at what stage do you roll up your sleeves and say, look, you better fix this? By just waiting, as they've done, you're only going to look at the mess in the doll. That didn't happen accidentally.
I know, and it's not going to be, we have to bring this to a close, but it's not going to be any easier with a new government, whatever way that's going to go. It's not going to be, or at least... Listen, your book, Tim Pat Coogan, 1916, The Mornings After. I know that we can get it on Amazon. And
but there's an edition. It's coming out of the States this year, Tom Dunn Books.
Okay.
Yeah. Full frontal American edition. But okay. You can get us through all those, you know, electronic things as well.
You're the keynote speaker there, my friend, Tim Pat Coogan, tonight at the annual dinner of the Westchester County AOH and Ladies of AOH as well. Good luck to you, and I know that you're going to be in the American Irish or the Irish American Historical Museum in Albany and places around the town. You're
Which
welcome
Pittsburgh
back
as well,
and Pittsburgh. I know. So just remember what my neighbor said. It's nice to see you coming and going, and you're not going anywhere soon. You're here, and you're promoting your book, and you're very welcome.
Well, thank you. Well, I would guess the AIH, which is also very pleasant, that's an underrated organization, at least it was for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
My old cousin, you know, Judge Comfort, was the guy who kept it at the... He kept it, you know, on Fifth Avenue, when people would have liked to see them. Disporting themselves in Central Park. So I have a certain affection for the AOH. I mean, There they are. They keep the flag flying, you
absolutely.
Know?
And that's Tenpak Hoogan, thanks for joining us. And good
always
luck,
a pleasure, Amy.
Your...
Very sincerely. God bless you.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Tenpak Hoogan, friend indeed, an icon and an historian, and he's stuck in everything. A broadcaster, journalist, and author. And you're listening to Irish Radio Network USA. Matter of fact, friends, you're listening in the New York area. You are listening to WVNJ 1160 AM, Oakland, New Jersey, New York, Connecticut. You indeed could be listening to us anywhere in the world as our program is simulcast and then archived on irishradio.com.